Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah. You already know what time it is. It's that official time. Where we take this worldwide. Let's go. Listen. So now it's time to turn it up. Surf the radio waves as we begin to burn it up. We all up in your area like landscape, definitely bringing you the power slamming pancakes. It's a mandate that you tune in. It's time to move out so we can move in and recognize that this is no illusion. I'm here to clear the air so that there is no confusion. It all started off in the book of Genesis when Jacob was wrestling with who he thought was his nemesis. And when the man saw he couldn't overpower him, he touched his hip but he really couldn't have devoured him. And from that point, then we hear a name change, rearrange the game, so now we gotta change. So I'm here to let you know it's time to listen to the Pancake and Power Slam Show. Let's go! Listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show by Crave Wrestling on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to follow Crave Wrestling on Twitter at Crave Wrestling and join the Facebook fan page Crave Wrestling.
Episode 190. Indeed, it's the Pancakes and Power Slam Show. We are live and in living color, getting funky like a monkey, if you will. I am Chris Featherstone, as always, here to have an amazing show, as we do every single week. Follow Crave Wrestling at Crave Wrestling on Twitter, like the Crave Wrestling fan page on Facebook. And you know how we do with our live streams at WAWNation.com and through Twitter at Crave Wrestling. Let us know how you feel. We have a lot to talk about tonight. Go home show on Raw to Survivor Series. Undertaker. And to spice up the Undertaker week that the WWE Network is having, the Crave Wrestling Pancakes and Power Slam Show would like to have our version of Undertaker Week. Someone, as you saw by the video that I posted, who's had very close encounters with The Undertaker and worked with The Undertaker, actually worked with The Undertaker in a very, very controversial feud and really immediately got himself established in the WWE. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, former TNA X Division champion and the manager of champions, Sean Daivari, how are you tonight?
Hey, guys. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing very, very well. It's great to have you tonight, sir.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Absolutely. So, it didn't take you long to... You have a very enviable journey to professional wrestling. You got a very, very a good spot at a young age. Now, how were you able to use what type of connections did you have to be able to? I think you were 20 or so when you first got an opportunity to be on the main stage.
Yeah, I was 20 years old when I started with the WWE. There was a guy named Dr. Tom Pritchard who used to find independent talents. You know, that was his job for WWE. Kind of does what a guy named Canyon Seaman does now, and you know, he's the guy that back then we had like videotapes, so I would wrestle on the weekends in these smaller independent shows, and someone would take like a camcorder and videotape it, and then we would take a videotape, and I would mail it to Dr. Tom, and he would watch it. He'd give me a call and be like, you know, this is good, this is bad, you know, work on this, work on that. And then I'd send him one every 4 or 5 months or something, and then finally got to the point where he said, Sean, just call me every week. I want to talk to you. Like, I see improving. So every Friday at like 3 p.m., that was like my slot where I'd give him a call and we would just chit-chat. He would ask where I wrestled over the weekend, who I've been working with. And then after a series of those phone calls, he says, you know what, we're starting this new character in OVW. It's going to be Mark Magnus. We're going to repackage him as Muhammad Hassan. He's going to be a Middle Easterner. And I think you guys would be a perfect fit as a group, because the group was actually originally supposed to be Jimmy Snuka Jr., who ended up wrestling as Deuce as part of the Deuce and Domino tag team, and Muhammad as a tag team with myself as like a manager. And there's even talks then about bringing in Khali as like an enforcer. So we're going to be like a whole like Al-Qaeda type group. But then eventually one time Vince McMahon came down to OVW. It was the first and only time he'd ever been there. And when he saw Magnus, he was like, nope, this guy is my singles main eventer. It's going to be him. He's going to manage. It's not a tag team. This is going to be a big money angle. And then we took off from there.
Wow. That is absolutely incredible. So how did you even get into the pro wrestling business? Was this something that you knew from a child that this is what you want to do? Was it like, you know, was there a specific show that you watched or a specific match that you watched that you knew that this was it for me?
You know, it never became a reality. Of course, like, I always wanted to be a wrestler, just like kids want to be astronauts and firefighters and stuff. Like, it was something that I hoped to do. But it wasn't until I was like 15 or 16 years old that, you know, I was in high school and we had high school guidance counselors. I had to be 15 because I started when I was 15. And my high school guidance counselor was just like, what is your plan after high school? What colleges are you submitting applications to? Are you going to go into the workforce? Are you going to go in the military? And then I was just like, shit, I never thought about that. Like, I don't know what I'm going to be doing after high school. And then I was like, I guess I'll just go to the WCW power plant, because that was the only thing I knew existed because they ran commercials on Nitro. And then after doing some more research, I found out there's wrestling schools, you know, all over the country. And there happened to be a great guy in Minneapolis named Eddie Sharkey, who trained like more world champions than anybody. He trained the Road Warriors. He trained Jesse Ventura. He was a big influence on Xbox's career. You know, Jerry Lynn, all these guys, you know, anyone that went through the Minnesota Midwest territory, Eddie had his fingerprints on them. And I was going, man, this guy's got a better track record than WCW Power Plant. Like, I'll just start with him now. And I was 15 years old, and I went to wrestling school.
Wow. And that's how...
I mean, there's a good chance if I didn't live in Minnesota that I wouldn't have started maybe till after high school, if not ever. But I was just in the right place. You know, I happened to be in the right territory where the AWA used to run, and I happened to meet the right guy who was desperate for money, so he would take anybody, even though I was 15 years old, to sign the injury waiver, or if I broke my neck, he wasn't responsible, and he needed the money, so he started training me.
Yeah. Now, you had some now before you came to the WWE, you had a couple of blurbs in TNA, right?
Yeah, I did two dark matches for TNA. I think it was the last one I did that kind of made WWE take me a little more seriously, because I think they had Paul London, somebody else, I can't remember, and then myself and Ken Kennedy all wrestle kind of consecutively, and WWE was kind of one by one snatching us up, because they would see, you know, they would see that, like, this guy could possibly be something, so they didn't want TNA to have him. They wanted to snatch him up. And, yeah, I had a tag match with Ken Kennedy there. I wrestled Amazing Red, and I think I had a match with Austin Aries. Maybe I had three of them, but I can't remember for sure. Jerry Jarrett loved me, but, you know, Jeff Jarrett, I think, didn't see much in me at the time. You know, they were kind of more focusing on talent that had previous TV exposure. So nothing ever really panned out.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your promo work like money at the time? Like, what type of dollar signs did Vince and Pritchard see coming to the WWE that got such a prominent spot so early in your career and so much at a young age? Were you doing like mic work? You know, when they were looking at you in OVW, was it your in ring talent that they were impressed with? What was it that made them look at you and say, "Perfect manager"?
I think that was when Vince came down to OVW and he heard me cut a promo, and it was one of those things that like. A good promo always comes from someplace real in your heart, just like a good story or a good novel or, you know, whatever, any piece of art, music, whatever it may be. If it comes from inside your body, like a piece of your soul, it's going to be better than something that's just, you know, factory generated. And I was living in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which is like a white bread town where, you know, black people and Asians and Mexicans were considered foreigners, but there really wasn't any, you know, and I thought I was a white kid, you know, pretty much until 9/11, because I was never treated any differently. And then after 9/11, I really started feeling like a minority, and I never felt that before. So there was a little piece of me that kind of held that resentment, and when I was able to kind of do those characters, I was like, holy crap, these characters are exactly how I felt in 2001. Like, I'm an American. I'm one of you guys. Why are you guys turning your back on me? I don't get it. I thought we were buddies. And that was the ability to really pull from someplace real, and I think gave me that little bit of extra juice that was something that kind of caught Vince's attention and said, if he puts, you know, Muhammad and Daivari together, because Muhammad wasn't a legitimate Middle Easterner, he was an Italian, that the act could work. And it did.
Oh, yeah. It sure did. And was it jitters that you were, did you feel comfortable in that position since it was given to you so early in your career and you were at such a prominent position? I mean, you guys were just really, it didn't take you long to be a main event caliber, you know, tandem. And I remember y'all on SmackDown. And then it was kind of like, I think on Raw, you guys had something with Michaels at the time, and there was Hogan at Mania. It was just so much handed to you in so little time. And I mean, how did you feel about that? Was it something, that you were comfortable with already, or were you nervous?
I was always comfortable with it at the time. I didn't really appreciate it though as a fan. Because, man, when you're with the WWE, everything moves so fast. You go from pay-per-view to Raw, you go home for a day, and then you fly back out, and then you got four house shows, and right back to Raw, then to the next pay-per-view, and then every pay-per-view gears to Survivor Series, Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, and, like, when you're moving at that pace, you never get a chance to stop and smell the roses. And, you know, now I'm 30 years old. Actually, I think I'm 31. I'm 31 years old. I can look back at it and kind of, like, be like, man, a 10-year-old, a 10-year-old Sean Daivari would have loved to sit back and watch this kind of stuff. I really didn't get to appreciate it. But then now that, you know, I'm just doing the independent scene and Lucha Underground, my schedule is a lot slower. Everything moves at a much slower pace where I can really appreciate the stuff I'm doing. Whereas before, everything was such go, 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 go. You never had a chance to really take it in. As far as my comfort level, I was always comfortable doing it because I believed in myself as a talent. And I think because I believed in myself, the office believed in me. And there's that little bit of arrogance that, you know, every successful talent carries this arrogance that says, I should be the guy. And if there's anyone that has any doubt in their mind that maybe I'm not cut out for this, maybe this isn't for me, usually it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that. Now, with that, though, how was your perception, you and Muhammad Hassan, how was your perception to others in the back? Because it didn't take either of you, you know, long at all to be in such a prominent spot, and you have so many people in the back that are just grasping for anything, and they've been in the business for so long. How was the morale in the back at the time as far as how people perceived you and treated you?
They treated me like gold, and they treated Muhammad like crap, and it was totally, totally unjustified. When I got signed and I started with the Raw brand, I'd already done, I think, like 13 dark matches, you know, 13 tryout matches that Dr. Tom set up for me. And, you know, back then, 2002, 2003, around that time, there really wasn't considered extra talent. If you were a wrestler, you were a wrestler. You would go in the locker room, I would change clothes with Triple H, and I would, you know, get dressed with Hurricane and all those other guys. Now, if you're an outside talent, they kind of keep you segregated to a separate area. You don't mingle with the talents. You don't talk to the office. An agent doesn't really put your match together. But back then, they did. You were just considered just another talent. Like I said, I had like 13 or 14 tryout matches across 2002, 3, and 4, I think. So when I got there on Raw, I was very familiar with everybody. It wasn't like a new guy coming in. Everybody knew me. Like I mentioned, Hurricane, he was always super nice to me right from the get-go. We became good friends. Jericho was awesome to me. Benoit was awesome to me. But then Muhammad is his first time up, and he looked like $1 million. You know, he was way bigger than I was. I wasn't considered a threat to anybody. I wasn't going to take anyone's spot. If I was going to do anything, I was going to end up in the cruiserweight division, which was such a low priority to begin with. Oh, it's not threatening anybody. But Mark, he was really put in a great spot. He had a great body. He was a great wrestler for how little experience he had. And that threatened people, and that got people upset that were either doing this longer than him or were more talented than he was, and why they couldn't get the break. But the crowd reaction was the proof in the pudding. Like, when he went out there, when we went out there, there was so much more heat. The next closest guy to us was, like, way down the line. There wasn't – I mean, that pretty much got us moved to the SmackDown brand, because we were hotter than the spot we were supposed to be in. We weren't supposed to be in the top spot on Raw, but we had that much heat. We were the top heels. So they said, you know, the top spot on Raw for a heel isn't for you guys, but – that top spot you could have on SmackDown. And when I got switched to SmackDown, they were going to have a world title run with Mark, and we were going to do, you know, great things with Batista and a couple other characters, because they didn't have that red-hot heel anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You guys were the modern-day, you know, Iron Sheik and Adnan, you know. And it was, you know, 15 years later, there was such a stark comparison to, I mean, that was probably one of the most controversial heat magnet angles that WWE's ever had. And to capitalize on this tragedy / controversy, you know, there was so much heat in that as well. Now, were there people who were so sensitive to, I mean, rightfully so, were there people that were so sensitive to the attacks that they couldn't buy into what you were booked as doing? I mean, could they not separate the reality from the fiction?
I don't think so, because anytime we'd run into a fan at the airport or, like, you know, grabbing a bite to eat, all he wanted was an autograph and take a picture with you or something like that. Mm-hmm. I never recall having any sort of, like, serious heat. The fans kind of got it, and they played their part. We played our part as the villains, and they played their part as, you know, the ticket-buying fan that hates us. But Summer Arena's got a little rough. Like, we got, you know, I don't know why people had them, but I got a lot of AA batteries thrown at me, and those things really hurt coming from, like, you know, 20 rows back, and, you know, a lot of sodas and popcorns that other people weren't getting. You know, we were attracting that kind of heat. But I remember Sergeant Slaughter telling me that he used to have to travel, like, in a unmarked car or something that was, like, very low-key and drive away, because they would slash his tires, and, you know, back in the day, they really didn't differentiate sports entertainment from reality. The most heat that we ever had, though, where fans were, like, legitimately mad, was when I was managing the Great Khali. We squashed Grey Mysterio in San Diego, and it's not that we had so much heat. They just loved Rey that much that when we were leaving, they were banging against our rental car, shaking it, throwing coins at it, leaving chips in the windshield and stuff. Like, that was the one where I had to pull out of there, you know, and I was fairly confident I was going to run somebody over, because they're standing in front of the car and they were not moving until we got out, and they were either going to kick our ass or have a group, you know, shoot us or stab us or something. So I just pushed the gas pedal. I'm like, dear God, please get out of the way, kind of like pigeons. And luckily everybody split and we got out of there. But that was the most heat I ever had, was killing Ray in his hometown.
Yeah. Which makes sense, because a lot of, you know, there's a lot of people in the San Diego, you know, community that are fans of Rey Mysterio and his Mexican wrestling background, and so I definitely see that. So you had an opportunity to work with some big names, starting with, you know, you're probably the beginning, within less than a year of your tenure in the WWE, you had a big storyline with Hogan at a WrestleMania. How did that?
That was awesome.
Go into that a little bit. How was it booked? Who came up with the idea? Let us know a little bit as far as the backstage, I guess, evolution of that angle, and how did you feel about doing it?
So I figured out more and more about it as time went on. Hogan really came out of retirement for that one more match. You know, obviously it was a good payoff, and obviously the thing fit for him, but they needed some content for his show, Hogan Knows Best, and they they thought of a story of him coming out of retirement and questioning whether or not he should, and his family being against it, and then him doing it. I found this out way after the fact, but that was a big piece of the puzzle of him coming back to WWE, was to get some content for Hogan Knows Best. Going into WrestleMania, we were, you know, like I said, pretty hot. Like, we had a lot of heat and we were pretty good, and they told us we weren't booked on the card, and both me and Mark were kind of like, that's odd. Like, yeah, it doesn't seem like we should be left off the card. And then every week as we got closer to it, like, we had no solid angles. We're kind of in something with Shelton Benjamin, but Shelton was booked in the Money in the Bank match, so we knew we weren't going to do anything, and we were just kind of puzzled by it. And then one day Michael Hayes came up and says, yeah, we got an idea for you guys for WrestleMania. We're just kind of figuring it out right now. You know, maybe something will happen, maybe not. Just don't hold your breath. And then we got there the day of, like, literally that afternoon at, like, 4 p.m., they told us what we were going to do. Like, Eugene didn't know, we didn't know. Only person that knew was Hulk and Vince, and I guess some of the agents or writers. And the really cool part for me was I was pretty much out of the picture. It was Mark and Eugene and Hogan doing their thing, and Pat Patterson was the one that came out. He's like, you guys have it completely backwards. Like, Daivari's the heat, like, you know, what we're going to do is we're going to have them get the heat on Eugene. Right away, Hogan pitches Muhammad out of the ring, and then everything is done with Hulk and Daivari. And we went through the whole Hogan comeback with the boot and the leg drop and the flexing and everything. And that was really cool. And I thought that, you know, Pat Patterson had that kind of faith in me over Mark in running that spot like that instead of having Mark in there, which is the way it was originally booked.
Yeah, I remember that vividly. And how much, you know, and this, the funny thing about that is that you get your matches within WrestleMania. Of course, anyone making a WrestleMania card, you know, I'm sure is elated that they, I mean, that's what any wrestler dreams of, to be on WrestleMania. But to have such a prominent storyline and have such a prominent spot within the event, to have a segment, you know, that's absolutely incredible. It's absolutely amazing. We see things like, as far as, you know, The Rock and Ronda Rousey with Triple H and Stephanie. You see segments like that. You know, you see the segment at 30 where, in the very beginning, where you had Hogan, Austin, and Rock. You know, and it was absolutely amazing to see, you know, something like those segments are memorable. And another memorable segment is the one that you had at 21. You know, segments like that within WrestleMania are the ones that resonates in people's minds over the years. And, you know, kudos to you and Mark, of course, you know, for having one of those segments with Hulk Hogan. Now, was Hulk Hogan, was it a matter of just, you know, I'm coming out here for business? Or was he really encouraging you and Mark, you know, to really give it your all? And was he kind of going, you know, moved toe to toe, you know, head to head, as far as like moves and just different spots and things like that? Was he really invested in the particular segment, or was he just coming out, you know, for business? How was he with that, and how was he overall backstage?
Well, that was kind of like WrestleMania was just, like you said, it was just a segment. It was not that big a deal. But the next pay-per-view was Backlash, where me and Mark actually tagged against him and Shawn, and it was a full-blown match. And he was, like, totally cool, way cooler than I expected. He was kind of the one that came out there and was like, yeah, you should make fun of us for being these washed-up old wrestlers, and, you know, rip the bandana off my head so everyone can see, you know, how bald I am and this and that. Like, he was really, really invested into it. I remember there's a point where Shawn was kind of like, you know, I don't really like the idea of the heels cutting down the babies so much, because it kind of gets to the point where sometimes the fan goes, oh, yeah, they're right. They are kind of old, and they are kind of past their prime or whatever. So I remember Hulk was so into it one time, Shawn had to pull the reins back a little bit. But he was so cool, man. The only issue he had this little back problem that was something that kept him from doing the leg drop. That was the only thing I remember. But he was 100% in the match. He had his own private dressing room, just showed up with a 24-pack of Miller Lite. We all just sat around drinking beer and talking. And then, you know, the match happened, and it went off like gangbusters. Boston's a great, great town for wrestling. Best arena, too, Dunkin' Donuts Arena. And it was magical. Like, everything fit into place. And I really, really feel that Backlash always, you know, I don't know if even that's a pay-per-view after WrestleMania anymore, but Backlash's main event was always a rematch from the WrestleMania main events. And I really feel that year, me and Mark and Hogan and Shawn had way more way more steam behind us than the rematch of, I think it was Triple H and Batista.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And just to be, you know, just to be 21 years old at the time, 21 years old going against both Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels, you know, in the same match. It's just, I mean, like I said, it's just really an enviable position for you to have, and it's absolutely incredible. So, you know, it's awesome that we don't see that a lot. You know, that was over 10 years ago. We don't see that a lot as far as people getting those type of meteoric rises and working with the big names, you know, these days. But, you know, for someone being as young as you were, you know, to have such prominent spots, you know, people like you, people like Rene Dupree, you know, he was, what, 19 when he won the tag team title. So, you know, young names like that to work with big names is absolutely incredible. So, and the thing is with you and Mark, Muhammad Hassan, is that the angle didn't last long, though. So, what was it that was talked in the back where people, you know, continued to try to peel and try to pull you guys away from each other because you guys were so much of heat magnets, so big of a draw so early in your career? What was it that led to the just annulment, basically, of you guys as a team? And before that, How was Shawn Michaels in the back as a whole?
Shawn was cool, man. I remember, like, my first match, you know, I was always a manager on the show, and my actual first match was against Shawn on Raw. And I would say there's probably 9.5 or 9.9 out of 10 wrestlers would not let a guy who's been featured as a manager get so much in and, you know, take advantage of a guy so much in a match, like Shawn did. Shawn went out there as if we were equals, and like, if I went out there with any other wrestler and we were compared as equals or whatever, like, that would be one thing. But this is like Shawn. He's like he's the top guy. He's the man. And for him to go out there and like say that, yeah, you know, whatever, we're on the same page. You tell me your shit. You tell me what you like to do. We'll do that. And then, you know, I'll get my stuff in, and then boom, 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 we wrap it up. And I just couldn't believe it. He was just kind of just listening. I was telling him, I'm like, well, these are the moves I do. I do this, I do that. And he goes, okay, cool, yeah, I can take that. Yeah, that's fine, no problem. And I was kind of in the back of my head going, what is going on here? What planet am I on? Because another thing, too, was Shawn was, like, one of my favorite wrestlers, even as a kid. So it was, like, him and Chris Benoit were, like, my two heroes. So it was kind of like working with them was like, an unreal dream come true. If you went to, like I said, a 10-year-old version of me in a time machine and told him one day you're going to wrestle Shawn Michaels, I think my head would explode. But yeah, he was really cool. And I'm sorry, you had a second question too. Oh, what got us pulled? Pretty much it was the network overreacting. We taped the SmackDown segments on Tuesdays is when they taped SmackDown. They used to air on Thursdays. And somewhere a Thursday morning, the London bombings happened, and we did a stupid angle with terrorists coming out and like, you know, beating up the Undertaker and stuff. And it was just bad timing. And somebody who didn't do some journalist who didn't do his research, who didn't really, you know, follow wrestling or know anything about anything, just wanted to get an article out there. And he wrote how terrible taste it was for WWE to broadcast this content, you know, in wake of the London bombings, not even knowing that SmackDown was taped on Tuesday. We didn't have a crystal ball where we looked in the future and saw this was going to happen on Thursday morning. We had a 15-minute segment in the can from Tuesday that was going to air on Thursday, and there was no way they could have even filled that time if they did pull it. You know, the best thing they could do is run a disclaimer on the bottom where they wrote that, you know, this show is going to, I forget what it said, but they ran a disclaimer across the bottom about it being, you know, adult content and entertainment only and blah, blah, blah. It was all they had time to do. But this journalist wrote about how poor taste it was and what bad taste it was, and then it got picked up by the AP wire, and once it's on the AP wire, it's in, like, every single newspaper and every single publication.
Right.
You know, that's out there. And then it was just an overreaction from the network, UPN at the time. It was CW, I don't remember. It was either CW or UPN, whoever it was. At the time, they said, like, these characters cannot be on our show. And this is back when the draft was pretty legitimate. So they said, we just got drafted to SmackDown. So they said they couldn't send us back to Raw because it totally delegitimized the draft. Plus, we weren't pegged to be the top heels on Raw anyways, which is why they moved us in the first place. So pretty much the solution that they came up with is to kill it. And that's something that Vince does sometimes. He works on something, it works on something, and then one day he'll just be like, nope, not today, it's done with, I'm over it. And then, you know, wow. We will always just say the toys go in the toy box. We just go in the toy box, and once in a while he'll pull us back out to play with us, but then he gets a new toy and throws the old toy in the toy box, and the new toy is his favorite thing.
Wow, yeah. And how were y'all told? Like, what was the conversation, you know, backstage of telling y'all? Do you recall vividly who told you and how it was told to you? And because I remember that it was like you went against Taker on SmackDown, and then The Undertaker just crushed, you know, Mark at the, I think it was like the Great American Bash or something like that. How were y'all told that this was it?
It was Vince. Vince pulled us into his office and told us that there was just too much backlash coming from us, and the network asked that, you know, the network said that we weren't going to be on the air anymore, and he was really frank about it. He says, I'm going to pull the characters. You guys are done. You know, you guys go home, and then we're going to figure something out and either, you know, bring you back or figure out something new. And he was really blunt and short about it. And then Stephanie came up to me. She's like, we got an idea for you for, like, next week. And she's like, we want you to debut with a character named George W. Bush, and we want you to wear red, white, and blue trunks and be, like, a super, like, American patriot. And that's when I was like, Stephanie, like, I would love to kind of do my own thing on SmackDown with the cruiserweights and stuff, but, like, that is a terrible idea. I don't know who came up with it or whose idea was to name me George W. Bush and take me from the hottest heel to wearing red, white, and blue and what the purpose is or the explanation is for it. But, I really, really feel strongly against it. And then she kind of pondered it for a second. She goes, yeah, maybe we could think of something better. I went home for 3 months. I was able to come back as Daivari in the main events with Kurt Angle and John Cena, and that's when I was just thanking God that I was like, thank God I turned on that George W. Bush thing, because I probably would have been fired somewhere along the way, because that thing was a stinking rock that was going to sink.
Now, and she was serious about that?
Yeah, she was 100% serious, and I don't know if it was her idea. I doubt it was her idea, because when I kind of explained how stupid I thought it was, she's kind of like, yeah, it is pretty dumb, isn't it? Like, so I think it was kind of like a knee-jerk reaction where one of the writers or creatives came up with his idea and pitched it real quick, and Stephanie's like, that sounds like something we could do. And I don't think there was any specific request to pull me from the TV show, because like I said, I was an accessory to Muhammad's character. They just said they wanted Muhammad off the TV show, so I think they kind of assumed I was in the clear.
Mm-hmm. Now, how in the world did – I mean, that's insane to me that would be pitched to you. Now, as far as Mark is concerned, I mean, we never saw him again. So was it his decision to just kind of ride off in the sunset after he was told that? Was there any talks of bringing him back in some form? Or was it just – because I know – as far as I remember, he went into acting or something like that, or just wanted to pursue a career. Was it more of his decision to just not come back again, or was it just a matter of just them not finding anything for him?
Yeah, no, that was exactly like you said. He was the hottest thing on the show as far as the heel was concerned. And when they pulled us from the show, you know, they were like, he said, I'm coming back where I left off, or I'm not interested in coming back. And they call me and they're like, can you go to OVW for a week? And I go, yeah, sure. And I go down to OVW and I'd wrestle around and I'd go home. And then another month would go by and they're like, oh, we just opened up this Deep South Wrestling. You want to go down there for a week? I'd be, yeah, sure. I went down there and they made the same offers to Muhammad, and both times he said, nope. And then they offered him the Deep South Wrestling thing. He said, nope, not interested. So he was kind of digging his own grave, but he was content with doing so. Like, we used to keep in, I don't talk to him much anymore, but we used to keep in close touch, and it's one of those things that he never did any independent shows. He didn't do like interviews or autograph signings. He just said, I'm done. He's like, if I'll come back to the wrestling business, if I can pick up where I left off, but if I'm going to do anything less than where I was before, I'm not interested. And then you were correct that he went into acting, and then he went into screenwriting. And I believe now he's a high school history teacher in New York, which is what he used to do. That's what he was studying for. He was in college, and it's just a few credits away from being a high school history teacher. And he dropped out of college to go to OVW to try and be a wrestler. And And then after the acting thing and the screenwriting thing ran up, he went back to school, got his degree, and that's what I believe he's doing now.
Wow. So, yeah, that was 10 years ago. And he's never stepped foot back in the ring, right?
Nope, never did an interview, never did an autograph signing, an appearance, nothing.
Wow. How far was that supposed to go? I know you talked about, you know, possibly making him champ, but, well, I mean, was there really serious talks about him being a world champion? And I've even heard, you know, I've been doing journalism for quite some time and been just knowing wrestling and following wrestling material backstage for quite some time now. I've even heard rumors of him potentially breaking the streak. Now, was that ever talked about either?
It has never been brought up to me. If that was the plan, it's the first I ever heard of it. I know we were booked through SummerSlam, and the idea was to beat Batista for the world title in Washington, which would, A, get us a ton of heat because it's America's capital, and B, it was
right.
Batista's hometown. And that's something that Vince loves doing. Vince loves crushing people in their hometowns. He thinks it's, like, the best heat that heels can get. So if they're ever in Boston, you can guarantee John Cena is going to get beat, or, like, we killed Rey Mysterio in San Diego, and the same thing was supposed to happen between Mark and Undertaker, I believe, was a number one contenders match. Maybe it wasn't. I'm not sure. But the angle was for him to beat Undertaker at Great American Bash and go on to SummerSlam to wrestle Batista, beat Batista for the title in the nation's capital and Dave's hometown. And that was as far out as I had heard anything beyond that from going into Royal Rumble and Survivor Series and Mania, the next set. I don't know if I just was out of the loop or it hadn't been booked yet, but as far as I know, it was to beat Dave in his hometown in Washington, D.C.
Wow. And, of course, I would imagine Mark was just, you know, he was fine with that. What was his demeanor usually with that? Was it a matter of excitement? Did he feel like he was supposed to be there? What was his mindset during all that time?
He was screwed with quite a bit, so his mind was back and forth. He was 100% qualified for the position he was in. He was doing an amazing job at what they asked him to do. But like I said, all those other wrestlers that were either jealous or intimidated or just resentful for how much he got so soon, so fast, they messed with his head, and they would screw with him a lot. So he would kind of go back and forth on whether or not he was capable of doing it or he was doing it. And sometimes they sucked the passion out of him by, you know, riding him so hard. That kind of stuff made him be iffy, but that was 2005. Like, today, the locker room is such a completely different scene. If anyone comes in that's going to be treated like Mark was, which nobody has been or probably ever will be again, but if anyone would come in like that, they would have the utmost support from the locker room because it's a different crew of guys. Now it's a crew of guys that aren't, you know, the tail end of the Attitude Era that were able to hang around and kind of are seeing the change in the wave. Now we're totally in this new era. We have this whole new group of wrestlers, and it's a completely different environment, and it's one that's very supportive. So when you see new faces like Kevin Steen and stuff come out, you see them really supported by both the office and the talent working with them.
Yeah. Now, like you said, you know, fortunate for you, you end up getting a pretty good spot. You came in, you know, a few months later and ended up working with Kurt Angle. And,
yeah.
You know, you ended up becoming
Kurt Angle,
And you managed Kurt Angle, and you were the manager of champions, you know, specifically first Kurt Angle when he won the World Heavyweight Championship. I remember that because I remember both of you did a very good job drawing heat leading into the match against Cena at Survivor Series. I think it was that time. And then before we get into SmackDown and the championship, how did that come about? How were you plugged into working with Angle?
I think it came originally from Brian Gortz, who I stayed in touch with. He used to be the head writer for Raw. And they were having this problem where Cena was wrestling Kurt on the shows, and they were stuck in the angle. And because Kurt was so aggressive and so strong, and we hadn't really moved into like the kiddish area yet, the people were really behind Kurt. And then, as you know, a lot of adults kind of don't like John Cena, or they look down on them. They're adult wrestling fans. So even though they were running with John as a top babyface and Kurt as the top heel, the fans were reacting differently, and they were trying to figure out what they could use like a heater to get Kurt booed. And I believe it was Brian Gewirtz that came up with the idea that Daivari's just sitting at home, like we're waiting for something to do with him. Why don't we put those two together? He's got, you know, as much heat as anybody's ever had. And that kind of became my job for the next 2 years, was whenever they needed a main event guy who didn't have the heat, they put me with them, like they did it with Mark Henry and like they did with Great Khali and stuff. I was always just the guy that Vince really believed in me, and I was his heater. So whenever he needed somebody to get some heel heat pretty fast, he would pair them up with me, and that was my job, is to get the booze drawn from the crowd.
Yeah. And still you were young. You were only 21 at the time still, and it's just incredible just to see, you know, just how much you've achieved at a young age. And so the jump, you were able to jump with Angle over to, in a package deal, to SmackDown. And it was a battle royal, right, that he won the title?
Yeah, Dave tore his lat, I believe it was. So he was the world champion at the time, so he had to get surgery and couldn't wrestle anymore. So they held a battle royal on SmackDown to get, you know, a new world champion. And I think there were some people in Raw that didn't want Kurt on the show, and they kind of were pulling, kind of suggesting they get him off the show. And then they moved us over to SmackDown, where there wasn't anyone that could say anything. There wasn't any solidified baby faces yet that they really believed could do the job. Dave was the guy, and he was out with an injury. And then, you know, the next closest guy was Ray, but, you know, Vince had a little bit of a size issue, so he didn't want to put the title on Ray. So the best idea they came up with was just send us over there and put the belts on us. But then they ran into the problem of, you know, I was with Kurt, and now we needed a babyface to replace Dave, because Dave was in a babyface spot. And then, so that's where the idea of Mark Henry came up with the first program with Mark, and they suggested to turn on Kurt, where I turn on him and work with Mark instead against him. So maybe there'd be a little residual interest in that idea of a manager that turned his back on his former athlete.
Yeah, yeah. And that was interesting, too, because I remember Angle got so many pops that night. I remember watching that, and he was so over when he won the Battle Royal. I mean, for those listening, just kind of find that somewhere, I mean, on YouTube or somewhere, where that SmackDown show where Angle won the world title, he was so over. And, yeah, and just you were a heat magnet, so it just didn't make sense for, you know, for you to be managing a babyface, you know, at the time. And I think pairing with Mark Henry was actually a pretty good pairing, you know, in comparison to Angle and Henry feud, because I think they actually had, was it like a, I think they went against each other's Royal Rumble at the time, right?
I'm not sure what pay-per-view it was, but I remember, you know, Mark's one of those guys that he'd been around. He'd move up and down the card a lot of times from, you know, match one to main event to match one to main event. And, you know, he was kind of injury prone. So he was always on for 9 months and off for 4 months and on for a year and then gone for a year. And it was really hard to solidify him in that spot. But again, that was what Vince saw, is, you know, Kurt Angle's kind of a middle of the road size guy and Mark Henry's this big beast. And he saw that as his money-making angle on SmackDown. And then that was the same thing that, like I said, that Mark had been up and down, and he needed to get a lot of heat really fast. So that was his idea, put Daivari with him. And then the guy is ready. And, you know, he said there was a little bit of history with me and Kurt as well. So it all worked out okay in the end. And then we just moved forward from there. It didn't last very long. I think we went into a program with The Undertaker, and then I ended up working with Taker for almost a year and a half straight, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was very interesting too. And how in the world did it come about? Well, first of all, why so abrupt the ending with Mark Henry?
I think he blew his kneecap, didn't he? Weren't we doing
Saturday
night main events in a long time? And I think he like blew his knee out.
Yeah, I think that was it. I think that was the reason why they did something like that, because I remember he came back months later, and just I think he just like squashed Batista or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they paired you with Khali. How did that come about? Why Khali? What did they see in Khali? Did they want to? Was it an Indian appeal that they wanted to draw? Was it a marketing thing, a PR thing? And of course, you know, you've made it very clear that, you know, the answer to why you is because you're the one who, you were the one that was used to could automatically bring heat on someone. So you being paired
with
Khali
exactly
made perfect
why.
Sense.
There's no other explanation except for that was that Vince's historically loved Taker, because Taker's huge. Like, if you ever actually stand next to him, the guy's like 7 feet tall and like 250 solid pounds or 260, I don't know how much he weighs. Like, he's a big guy. So Vince has historically loved him wrestling guys bigger than him, but they're very hard and few to find in between. Like, you know, Mark Henry's a guy that was more dense than he was. Historically, he wrestled like Giant Gonzalez and against Nathan Jones and like, you know, they always like to find guys that are bigger than him, and they're just very rare. And they found another one, and right away when Vince was signed Khali, or when they signed Khali to a deal, his idea right away was to have him work with Taker because he saw money in a guy that, if you believe it, is bigger than the Undertaker and possibly poses a threat to him. Because it's hard to put Taker in a match in a position where he's threatened. It's really, really hard to do. You can't do that with most people, but Vince's hope always was a guy bigger than him could do that, where people would believe that they'd be a threat. And then, like you said earlier, he needed to get, he was an unknown guy, no name, no face, never seen before, and he needed to get ready to work with the top babyface on SmackDown in like 3 weeks, I think. So that's just right away how it just jumped into it, just put Daivari with him, and then there was never an explanation for it or anything. And then 3 weeks later, we wrestled The Undertaker and in a pay-per-view, and he killed him, and then we just went on, I think, for another 3 months doing it, and then we blew it off at SummerSlam, I believe. Or it was the SmackDown before SummerSlam, because they were afraid to do the match live. They thought it would be too crappy. So they wanted to do on SmackDown, and they taped it. It was promoted and advertised for SummerSlam, and then the Thursday before SummerSlam, they just did it on SmackDown so they could tape it and edit it in case the match came out bad, which it actually came out really good, which kind of sucked that we missed SummerSlam.
Was it the time that they ended up doing the Punjabi prison match and they threw somebody else in there? Was it Show or something like that they threw in there?
Yeah, that was one of those things where it was so screwy. We took some blood tests. That whole pay-per-view was screwed up. I don't know if you noticed. Like, every match that was advertised was changed to something different. And so because we did some blood tests earlier for hepatitis, and whoever was the lab that was doing the blood work didn't finish a lot of the talent's work by Sunday. So that Sunday, only the wrestlers that their hepatitis came back negative were the ones allowed to work. And there was, I think, like 7 or 8 wrestlers that were booked on the card that their blood tests just hadn't come back yet. So they didn't book them in matches. I think Finlay ended up wrestling Bobby Lashley, and that wasn't advertised. Bobby was supposed to work with someone else. And, like, I think, like, Ken was left off the card. And then, you know, who ended up wrestling? Big Show. Big Show ended up wrestling Taker because Khali's blood work didn't come back yet. So it was a really screwy pay-per-view just to begin with. And then the big blow-off was supposed to finally be SummerSlam, which ended up not happening. It happened at SmackDown before.
Yeah. You're right. It was Finlay and Regal, and I think it was Taker. Yeah, I knew it was Taker and Show in the Punjabi prison match. Yeah, It was a pretty odd. You're absolutely right, because I remember they were promoting other matches. I remember specifically that Taker and Big Show match, because I think it was like the day of or earlier in the Great American Bash that they just kind of changed the match up. they kind of chased the match up, and they just threw Big Show in there. And I was wondering if it was one of those things like they didn't have enough faith in Khali to actually, because it was like a big thing. Like, they were promoting this Punjabi prison match. And it was just always weird to me that, you know, Great Khali was the Punjabi whatever he was at the time. I remember when he became a babyface, he was like the Punjabi playboy, but he was the Punjabi something at the time. Yeah. And he was, he was booked from Punjabi, and they have it a Punjabi prison match, which was some wooden, weird-looking cage, and it had nothing to do with Kali. A Punjabi prison match that had nothing to do with Kali. It was just really weird to me that they ended up doing that. So, I mean, and you said it wasn't that bad of a match, and yeah, it wasn't horrible. But my question is, why would they even go that far to book a match with Taker and Kali when first he squashed? I mean, he just destroyed Taker at Judgment Day that year. How did that come about? Was Taker like full on willing to do that? Was he reprehensive towards Kali just coming in and squashing him without even having a huge proper build for Taker? Because, you know, Taker is all about, you know, quote unquote, making people famous. So a lot of times, even if you lose a match with Taker, you know, you get over. But with Kali, I mean, people were just so shocked because he destroyed Taker. How was that developed, you know, backstage?
I'm not sure where the plan came from, but Taker was on board the whole time. He believed in the angle, he believed in Kali, he believed in his look, and he believed in the fact that people would buy into a series of matches leading up to Taker getting a big win at a pay-per-view that matters, which was end up being SummerSlam. So
yeah,
he had faith in all of it, so he was on board, and he was cool with it.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I'm still shocked to this day how the match went, but I can see how that makes sense, because Judgment Day is, you know, for the most part at that time, was just a throwaway pay-per-view, so to get heat on Kali, I can understand why. It was just still quite shocking. So the latter part of your time with WWE, I know that you you know, had some time with Kali, and then you did some ECW time. How was your time there? Who made the decision for you to go to ECW with Kali and I start working? I think it was with Dreamer or something like that.
I think just SmackDown was over with him. I think they said that he can't do it. You know, he worked with Taker. Where does he go from here? And then ECW was a new brand at the time, and I'm 99% sure Paul Heyman didn't want us. He was just, I think it was a Vince call to put us on ECW. And Paul didn't want us there, I don't know who was that paired us as Dreamer either. There was never an explanation given to any of it, but Dreamer's like a close friend of mine, so I loved the program with him. But yeah, it was a really odd thing, and then that ended up just getting the plug pulled on it abruptly in a roundabout way, leading into the WrestleMania with Hogan and Donald Trump. But that's a long story.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, you guys just didn't really build much steam after that, though. I mean, what was that really the beginning of the end of your career there, or was it just? I mean, were there talks of just kind of really reviving anything, or were you just were the both of you just kind of backpedaling?
I think the Cruiserweight division, they never ever had faith in it. I think at that point in time, there was a good 2 months where they believed in it. And that's when they put me in there. Same thing. I was just moved to SmackDown because they needed to get me off ECW because they split me with Kali, because Kali was supposed to go work with Vince and Donald Trump, but that ended up not happening. And then I was again floating, and I was moved to SmackDown because they wanted to restart the Cruiserweight division. And we did some pretty good stuff for I guess it was about 2 months. They put us on pay-per-views. They gave us, 10 minutes each time. I think there was pressure on them to kind of match the X division a little bit. So we started doing all these crazy matches, like six-man tags and five-man gauntlets and, so on and so forth, kind of like TNA was doing. It's my best guess. Michael Hayes was the head writer of SmackDown. He always had faith in us. And then just one day it was over. They just decided that, they weren't going to run with the Cruiserweights anymore. And I think they put the belt on Hornswoggle, and then eventually they got rid of it. And then I got moved to Raw because I was supposed to do some pretty decent single stuff, but I guess it just never panned out.
Hmm. Yeah, and it became like the whole toy in the toy box thing again, basically. But at that point in time,
basically.
The chest was shut at the time. So it didn't take you a year for TNA to grab you. How did that come about?
I was in contact with Terry Taylor. I went straight from WWE. I went to All Japan. I was wrestling in Japan pretty regularly, and then I stayed in touch with Terry Taylor, who's like still a good friend of mine. I got booked at an independent show in Nashville, and then that's where TNA's offices is, obviously. And then I talked to Terry Taylor. I said, "Hey, let's have a chat." And I sat by and I talked with him, and we had a conversation. It was a good one. And he said, "Sean, if a spot opens up, like, I want you in there. It's a matter of time." And I think, it was about 6 months or 8 months after I was done with WWE that they did this World X Cup, and they had a team international. There was going to be a bunch of different international guys. And Terry, I think, spit my name out there, and they plugged me in there. And Jeff was kind of remembered me from doing the dark matches, and he was just like, time to sink or swim. And then, because I didn't have a contract, I was just working night by night. And then I ended up doing it, and then the World X Cup was over, and then I sat at home for like 2 weeks, and then Terry Taylor called me up. He's like, I did a good job. We got a deal for you. And then I ended up staying there for like 2 years, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, your time there was really good when you were Sheik Abdul Bashir.
It was the best TNA has ever done business-wise, and not because of me. I'm just saying at that period of time, it was the best business TNA had ever been doing.
Yeah, I mean it was really good stuff. It was a really good product at the time, and they really put you as again heat magnet because you draw heat so much, and it did a very good job doing that. You were really a legit heat magnet when you were Sheik, and it was really good to see. And again, how were you portrayed backstage? How was the morale overall?
Much cooler, much cooler. For me, it was always cool. Like I said, when I was in WWE, I was never a threat to anybody, so they were always cool with me. So I'd say it was about the same to me. But I could see how their locker room would be more open to someone like Mark or Muhammad coming in if he did, but obviously he didn't. But it was cool, man. Like I've been wrestling for a long enough time, and people that I've crossed paths with almost everybody. But anytime I go to the locker room, there's always a handful of people I know or that I've worked with, and it's always familiar faces. And especially at TNA, there's pretty much everyone I either worked with at WWE, worked with in Ring of Honor, or I worked with on the independent scene. There was maybe like two or three people that I hadn't worked with before that I didn't know, and I'm sure even then we kicked it off pretty well.
Yeah. Now, what led to your departure from TNA, and where do you think that they – how would you, say their status is at this point?
It's okay. I mean, it's a completely different animal now than it is. They don't have any money, and they're losing talent fast, so I don't even know if they'd be interested in bringing in someone new as much as they would be using payroll money to pay the people that they have. But I was always under the philosophy that Vince Russo just saw nothing in me and didn't want me on the show. I saw him at Lucha Underground like maybe 6 months ago or something. He came by to watch his shows, and he claims that he had nothing to do with it, and it was just a decision made by the office to free up some money or let me go because I was too much of a headache or whatever. So actually, it's a true story. I don't know. I know I was put on probation for complaining about doing an Australian show because they were going to Australia in the future, but they wouldn't confirm booking me. So maybe while I was on probation, I was, doing bad behavior and they decided to let me go. But I really don't know to this day.
Yeah. All right, real quick, just basically your time in ROH. You have moments there, and you had a good couple years during the Embassy and then Lucha Underground. Just give us just your experience working with ROH and Lucha.
ROH was cool. I was returning there. I'd wrestled there a few times before I got signed by WWE. And then my good friend Adam Pearce was a head booker at the time, so he promised me a pretty decent spot, and he offered me pretty good money. Like, I was actually shocked at how much money he was able to offer me, which is in the same ballpark of people that have been there for years and years. And for a new guy coming in, I was shocked that they were, going to compensate me that well and book me that much. But it worked out really cool. Just at the end of the day, Adam was let go as head booker. A new booker came in. The Sinclair thing happened, and they just, the new booking is delirious because the new booker of Ring of Honor, and he just probably never saw much in me or doesn't care much for me. So from there, I just pretty much, fizzled out. And then the Lucha Underground thing came about actually from friends pulling for me to come in, like Johnny Nitro and John Morrison and Chavo Guerrero and a few other people going to bat and talking to the office saying, like, hey, you got, you know, Daivari's just kind of doing the independent stuff. Why don't you bring him in? And then Krista Joseph, who's the head writer of Lucha, used to be the head writer of Raw, or sorry, assistant writer on Raw, so I know him pretty well. We used to drink quite a bit together after the shows and stuff, so everything kind of came full circle, and eventually they created a spot for me in Lucha.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, we're getting a bunch of people thanking you for your the incident a few years ago in the airport. So you are a respected citizen for what you did. So
thank you.
So well done. Awesome, Daivari. I appreciate your time, man. Awesome stuff. Any last words as far as what people should look out for?
I mean, we have season 2 of Lucha Underground is just starting, so that'll probably be on the El Rey Network in the next, like, 6 weeks or so. I'm not sure when it starts. But then, you know, just any of promoters or promotions or conventions out there, I still have SeanDaivari.com up and running. I'm not too big on social media, so I don't have a Facebook or Twitter or anything, but I'm SeanDaivari.com. If anyone wants to book me for shows, they can go on there and email bookdaivari@gmail.com and let me know if they have any conventions or seminars, autograph signings, shows, or whatever they want me for, and we can definitely have a chat.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Sean. You have a great one.
Cool, man. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You are now listening to the Pancakes and Power Slam Show, hosted by Chris Featherstone and Derek of Crave Wrestling. This is the new Tuesday Night Titans.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sean Daivari. Awesome, awesome. Such, you know, he achieved so much, you know, in so little time. And like, you know, he said and I said, 20 years old when he was in such a big prominent spot, you know, and that's such an enviable position. And he made much sense as far as, you know, him not being a threat, you know, he's what, 5'7", 5'8", something like that. And, you know, it's awesome to, and it's very interesting to see how people who get their spots like that aren't, you know, considered threats, but people like Muhammad Hassan, you know, who had a meteoric rise like Daivari did at the time, is labeled as huge threats. Very, very interesting insight by Daivari tonight.
Oh, it was excellent insight. And again, we have the best interviews here on Pancakes and Power Slams. And he's one of those individuals that just does everything that he can do in his power and make it work. I mean, 20 years old, starting out in the WWE. Are you kidding me? I was 22 when I first went down to HWA and scratched my head and thought I could do everything in the world. So, I mean, just being 20 years old on the biggest stage that you can be in this business, I mean, forget about it. I mean, the guy has done absolutely everything right, and he's just, I mean, he's still going strong in wrestling. And it's being 20 years old, that's so impressive to just, you know, have a long career for, I mean, he's younger than we are, Chris. So
yeah,
let's just keep that perspective.
Thanks
and,
for
I mean,
reminding
he's still me. Going, well, yeah, me too, but I mean, just keep perspective. He's got a long way to go in this business before he's considered old age. So, I mean, we've got a lot more to see from that guy.
Yeah, and that's a great point, too. And only being 31 years old, you know, just achieving. And it's like he has a career that people – He's had a career in 10 years that people dream about having their entire 20-year career, you know, to work, you know, within, at 20 years old, within months of his debut, 5 years of when he started wrestling as a teenager, to be able to, you know, wrestle against Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels. Absolutely incredible. Awesome, awesome there. So thank you again, Daivari, and we'll definitely be sure to plug this amazing interview. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go through Raw, and then we're going to talk about title changes from 2004 to 2014 from Survivor Series. And we're going to, of course, go to the predictions for Survivor Series. A very horribly booked Survivor Series. There was just an announcement today on WWE.com or yesterday on WWE.com, and of there's going to be a 5-on-5 Survivor Series match, but the names aren't announced yet. I don't understand how you can have a throwaway card concept at one, your big four pay-per-view, one of your big four pay-per-views, which of course is Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, and Survivor Series. And then secondly, your second oldest pay-per-view in the history of WWE recurring pay-per-views. So, you know, I think it was 87 that Survivor Series start. So you're talking about 28 years of Survivor Series nostalgia here. And what we get are, you know, semifinals and finals matches, Paige and Charlotte. And yeah, there's going to be a 5-on-5, but we're not going to tell you who the members are yet. What a improperly booked pay-per-view to be such a prestigious one.
It was like you just said, this is one of the originals. This is 1987, you're right. Every match was 5-on-5. And I mean, I love the idea of it. Anybody could be pinned and, you know, the team is still going. It's not like the whole team's eliminated. So you've got a lot to go on. And this has been like the past 20 years, 15, 20 years that they've just kind of, the Survivor Series was never really something as good as it used to be. And it's just now, I mean, especially this year, I mean, forget about it. I mean, who really cares who's in the 5-on-5? I mean, I'm sure it's just a bunch of throwaway names. I'm sure Neville will probably be in there.
Yeah.
You know, Cesaro might be in there.
Who cares? Big deal.
Yeah, it's a 5-on-5. But, hey, we've got Charlotte and Paige. We've got, you know, the Wyatts and the team, the Brothers of Destruction, which I'm not taking anything away from that, but that could be another pay-per-view. Survivor Series, treat it like you would. They still treat the Royal Rumble with dignity as far, well, I don't want to say too much of that, but they still have the Royal Rumble match. They still have 30 people in there. And so it's, you know, at Survivor Series, it's just another pay-per-view anymore. That's how they book it.
Yeah. Survivor Series trivia, ladies and gentlemen. Which Survivor Series was subtitled The Gravest Challenge? Which Survivor Series was subtitled The Gravest Challenge? This week and next week, full of Survivor Series trivia. Survivor Series and Undertaker trivia. All right, let's skim through Raw. But before we skim through Raw, I mean, you have... I've been in this world same amount of years that you have, Derek, and we've experienced a lot. We are wrestling historians, but we also love sports. And we recall the Tyson Buster Douglas. We recall George Foreman and Michael Moore. We recall moments like that, that is, of course, we recall The Undertaker's losing streak. There are just certain moments in the life of sports that you can never, ever duplicate. And it would just pass on generation after generation after generation. And those things that I said has a new addition. They have a new addition to it. And that is a 34-year-old amazing boxer, world champion boxer, but in the UFC field, 10 fights, but, you know, 10 fights, undefeated, but still was a relative no-name in the world of in Ultimate Fighting. So she comes over to UFC and undefeated, but she was still just going to be another name. But not only was she not another name, she became the name. And that name is Holly Holm, creating history, eyewitness history, Saturday night, Sunday morning, when Holly Holm defeated Ronda Rousey. Absolutely incredible moment. And it's so interesting that it was at first, you know, because many people didn't really know who Holly Holm was, other than just, you know, the weigh-ins and all the bashing through Twitter and other social media platforms that Ronda Rousey did to Holly Holm and call her out her name and all types of derogatory statements. And so humble, even-keeled Ronda Rousey is what you saw in other matches. But you start to get the cocky, arrogant Ronda Rousey that just put Holly Holm as just another victim on her list. So because of that hype and because of Holm being a relative unknown, I thought that, you know, when Rousey was fighting in the beginning, I was like, man, she's going to get humbled. And then her previous fight, I was like, oh, yeah, okay. So her previous couple fights, I was like, okay, I'm starting to respect Ronda Rousey. I'm buying into her love for professional wrestling. Piper, you know, passed around the time that her fight was last time. And so, you know, she's a big wrestling fan, got rowdy from Piper and so forth. So I started to become a fan of Rousey because of those things. But and so I started to say, okay, well, she's just going to be another name. Holly's just going to be another name. But it only took me, I kid you not, it literally took me about 20 seconds in the fight to say, oh, this is probably the one. She did her normal charge, but she charged the wrong person. I think it's best put as a matador del toros. That is the bullfighter who, you know, who avoids the bull charging him, and then just nails him with the dagger. The bull's gone, and that's how it was. It was a bullfighting match to me. The bull charging the matador, and the matador getting to a point where the dagger was drawn and Rousey was done. The left kick heard around the world, and, you know, followed by two or three, you know, just hammer shots that was really irrelevant to the purpose, because that left kick was all she wrote. So this historical moment of Rousey being KO'd.
Yeah, it was, and I was just as shocked as everyone else. I believed in the hype of Rousey, so, you know, it's going to be a fight. You know, Holly Holm, we'll see. Well, you know, to my surprise, I mean, sweet chin music always does it. I mean, does it not? So, yeah, Ronda Rousey, I don't want to say she's done. She's not over with. She could come back. They could make a rematch and redeem herself. Who knows? That's happened before in the past as well. So, you know, we'll see what happens if that ever does take place. Ronda Rousey's still a good fighter, terrific-looking person, but, you know, that just wasn't her night. That's too bad. Maybe she was unprepared. She took it too lightly. It happens a lot. So, I mean, I'm not making excuses for her. She was totally rocked. I mean, it was – she added nothing to that match other than Holm just totally dismantle her and,
right,
again, just absolutely destroy her. That was the whole match. Holm was – that was it. You know, Rousey,
yeah,
didn't even show up. So.
Pretty much. She did not. And then not giving her dap and, you know, with pounding the, you know, the fist. And it was just a nightmare on paper. It was just a nightmare waiting to happen with Rousey. I mean, she just set herself up to fail so much at the, you know, just different spots, the weigh-ins, the social media and the fight. It was just a nightmare waiting to happen with her. So we'll see if that opens up more WWE doors in the near future. But real quick, with Raw, the 91 was the Gravest Challenge. great job there. What type of match did The Undertaker compete in at SummerSlam 93? What type of match did The Undertaker compete at in WrestleMania? SummerSlam 93? Real quick with Raw, we get Undertaker and Kane in-ring promo. Wyatt family appears. Kevin Owens defeating Neville. Breeze defeating Truth. Ambrose defeating Ziggler. New Day defeating Ryback and the Usos. Reigns defeating Cesaro. Dudley defeating Ascension. Del Rio defeating Kalisto, who defeated Ryback on SmackDown. And then we get a Charlotte and Paige contract signing. Now, there's only probably two or three things that were just stood out, and not necessarily a good way. The promo with Taker and Kane was okay. It was okay. Owens and Neville was a good match. Ambrose and Ziggler was a good match. But you got New Day and the Ryback and the Usos by DQ, and because Ryback just goes berserk. So what does that have to do with anything, for one? Reigns and Star was very good, but like I said before, it was split. The cheers were split, and it was more towards Cesaro's. You know, Reigns did get over, but it was more towards Cesaro's way. So how in the world does that protect Roman Reigns? And we saw it. It manifested. What I said manifested at Raw, and I would even say the same thing with Ambrose and Ziggler. You're supposed to build Ambrose or build Ziggler, whoever you want to build as the babyface. And I'm a big fan of babyface versus babyface only when it makes sense, only when there's a proper build. Like when Austin and Rock, when they went against each other at 17, babyface versus babyface, and then Austin made the turn. That was great. And so Taker and Batista went against each other, babyface versus babyface. That was good, too. And there's been times where you've had, of course, Hogan and Warrior, probably the most popular babyface versus babyface match at WrestleMania in 1990. But, yeah, it just doesn't make sense, like Ambrose and Ziggler. So who are you going to build? Who's going to get, you know, a better – you know, draw and better steam going in. And Ambrose cuts a promo. It just didn't make sense. It was just awkward. Just so awkward. The Dudley boys defeating the Ascension. How does that make any sense? What's the point of that? And then of course, the Charlotte. You close the go-home show for Survivor Series with a Charlotte and Paige contract signing. Charlotte looked as nervous as a overweight person entering the treadmill the first time. That's the best way I could put it. I apologize if I offended anyone, but it's definitely not my intention. That's the best way that I could put it at the time, and that's nervous because I've been that guy before and started working out like crazy, and so I get it. I can relate to it. Nervous. You know, crying about Reed. I get it. I watched the table for three. I understand how important Reed is to Charlotte's career. Paige taking a jab at Reed. You know, I'm okay with Charlotte crying, you know, about Reed, because I mean that transcends wrestling. Her younger brother died, so I get it. But why incorporate that in a feud if you know that Charlotte wasn't able to, you know, hold herself up? It was just awkward, and in the way it went off, it was just lackluster. It really showed that the WWE is at a very, very huge lack when it comes to their booking staff. Something has to change immediately. Just poor writing. Poor writing.
Monday Night Raw last night was probably one of the worst Raw. I mean, there was nothing there for a go-home show to Survivor Series, which I'm almost betting, Survivor Series is going to be the biggest pay-per-view bust of WWE history. I mean, it's just, I'm not looking forward to it. I'll watch it, obviously, but it's one of those, I mean, this Raw did nothing for it. The company has done nothing to make Survivor Series good. It did nothing to make Raw great. I mean, and with the whole Paige and why was that even at the end of Raw? Why would they put that at the end of Raw? Why would they bring everything up? It went from like 1 to 100 in no time. And it's interesting because a lot of people probably don't know the background of Charlotte as far as, you know, Reed, you know, the thing, the tragedy that happened to him. And to bring that up, it just, yeah, it made no sense. It didn't create a reaction from the crowd because, again, it's personal as far as nobody, the average wrestling fan doesn't know, you know, that story and doesn't remember that happened. So why bring it up? Why make a point of it? And the thing that it was so uncomfortable for me as a fan watching is for the fact that it didn't make sense to the story. Again, not many people probably knew the backstory of it, and there was just absolutely no reason for it, and nobody reacted to it. Something that huge, that big of a egg you're going to throw, you want the people to react. You want, oh, wow, that's really, you can't believe they just said that. But also, it's like, you know, there's other people involved. There's family that probably didn't want her to say that and didn't want, you know, make that public to everybody in the world. It just,
yeah,
it was,
as my, her mom spoke up about that almost immediately, yeah, afterwards.
Exactly. And who needs that? Who wants that? I wouldn't do that personally to myself if that tragedy ever happened to me. So, you know, leave it off TV. That was absolutely ignorant. It was probably the lowest point I've ever seen the WWE because they wanted to make some big spectacle out of it. Too little, too late because you're, you know, days away from SummerSlam. And again, it was so irrelevant to the story. It didn't,
yeah,
need that. And it's just, to me, it's a shame that that had to be brought up. And that's it. It was just, it was, you know, a negative. It didn't make a positive reaction to me. It didn't make me want to see the match anymore. It just made me want to be like, what are these two women up to? I mean, this is, what is the WWE up to even let this go on? So,
and I totally agree. I totally agree. It did nothing to move the needle in a positive direction for me. It didn't add more suspense to the match. It was already a poorly booked match. There was some steam coming back, you know, from the Paige turn to, you know, Paige is kind of becoming number one contender. You know, there was some type of, some steam behind it, but this whole Divas Revolution has been such a huge flop that, you know, all the people who are in the Who got caught up, with the exception of Charlotte, you know, look at Becky Lynch. You know, Sasha Banks should be probably the main face, other than, you know, Charlotte's getting her moment, and I'm cool with that. But they should be grooming Sasha to be the main face right now in the Divas Division, period. But the Divas Division has been so tainted that it's not even really a good position to even do that. It was just incredibly ridiculous, and it did nothing to add suspense to the feud at all. It was just so poorly booked, and I'm just so surprised that it would even go out, you know, of the committee meeting to even go that far. It was so ridiculous. So, on a lighter note, let's talk some Survivor Series title matches.
It is now time for the Flavor of the Week.
2004, there were no title matches. There were title matches, but there were no title changes. All of the titles were maintained by JBL, Trish Stratus, Spike Dudley, and Shelton Benjamin. So that was interesting that no title changes in 2004. 2005, again, no changes. No title changes. Very, very interesting. There was a best of seven for the U.S. Championship. That was a pretty good match. And Daivari was a special guest referee in the Cena Angle match that Single retained. So that's very interesting that Daivari had a prominent spot there. 2006, we had Batista, the last chance match. He ended up winning the World Heavyweight Championship again. And then Mickie James winning the Women's Championship from Lita. 2007, we have, as far as title changes are concerned, we didn't, there were no title changes in 2007 either. It's interesting that there's a lot of Survivor Series pay-per-view since it's so revolved around the multiple people match that there is not a lot of title changes. But Edge won the WWE Championship in 2008, and John Cena, well, Vladimir Kozlov, I remember that. Kozlov and Edge was in that match, and Triple H, who had the title, and Jericho had the World Heavyweight Championship and lost against John Cena. And he left. And then as far as 2009 is concerned, there were no changes either. Both champions retained their titles, The Undertaker and John Cena. As far as 2010 is concerned, the title matches, Natalya beat Lay Cool in a handicap match to win the Divas Championship. I remember that. And that was it. All the other ones retained their championships. 2011, CM Punk became the WWE champion by beating Alberto Del Rio, starting his 434-day reign. And then as far as 2012 is concerned, no title changes either. CM Punk retained the title by defeating Cena and Ryback. That was the debut of quite an interesting faction at that time. I remember what the name is. And as far as 2013 is concerned, again, no title changes. Survivor Series is a pretty, the past 10 years has been a pretty interesting take on that. Just not a lot of title changes at Survivor Series. Nikki Bella started her year-long reign almost by beating AJ Lee in 2014. And then The Miz and Mizdow won the opener, the Fatal 4-Way match, becoming tag team champions. And, of course, last year was the debut of Sting. So real quick, give me 60 seconds or less, Derek. Which one of those 10 years was the most memorable title change for you?
I don't know. Anything with Jericho always typically ends up being pretty good. So, and it's almost, it kind of makes me reflect to the fact that 2016 is about the championship, and it's never really been much about the championship with Survivor Series. So it's, mm-hmm, kind of different this year. So, Clay, we don't have a whole lot to go off of. There wasn't really a title change when John Cena defeated Triple H and Shawn Michaels in 2009. But that was probably a really good one for me. I mean, it's Survivor Series again. It's not a really big championship-heavy pay-per-view. Should be more of a tournament. But we're going to find out this coming Survivor Series that there really is a championship match. It's going to be good. So I'm looking forward to that. I know I slammed on the Survivor Series earlier and said I just can't fathom what this is going to bring. It'll bring something. It'll extenuate. Probably the Monday Night Raw after Survivor Series is going to be even better than the pay-per-view. It's a good thing I have to pay for it at the network, but not to plug that. But honestly, my favorite was John Cena, Triple H, Shawn Michaels. Wasn't a title change. The match itself was great. I liked it.
Let's get to predictions here. I would say probably CM Punk, although I'm not a Punk fan, I would say probably CM Punk with his fourth, that'd be the start of his big reign. So, real quick, Tyler Breeze and Ziggler.
I've got Dolph Ziggler, definitely.
I think Breeze will go over. Brothers of Destruction versus Wyatt Family. Who you have?
Got the Brothers of Destruction defeating the Wyatts.
Bold prediction for me. I got the Wyatt Family. Check out my article on WAWNation.com for that. Does Charlotte keep her Divas Championship or no?
Yeah, I think she does.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Who wins the World Heavyweight Championship?
Roman Reigns. Doggone it.
I agree. I don't want it to happen. I want Roman Reigns to claw and scratch a little more, but I think that they're going to just take the easy route. I want to see an Ambrose turn or a Sheamus cash-in, but we'll see. So, all right, enjoy your Survivor Series. Nick Bockwinkel in Paris, just be in your prayers. Prayers go out to the victims and to Nick Bockwinkel's family. So enjoy your week of wrestling. God bless. See you next week. Bye-bye.